Welcome, everybody, to our weekly Parshat Shavua. It's a pleasure to welcome Rabbi Judah Kerbel back. He is the rabbi at the Queens Jewish Center, which, believe it or not, is in Queens, New York. And I haven't been there. I was there many, many years ago. It's been a long, long time. He is a graduate of Yeshiva University. He's learned in Gush, also a graduate of University of Maryland. That's a connection and a pleasure to have him back. And Vakasha, Rabbi Kerbel, it's all yours.
Thank you. It's great to be back. I told my shul that this is like almost, you know, an annual shiur for me now. So Yirtzeh Hashem, we should continue learning together. So what I wanted to discuss tonight is something that's been on my mind for a while, which is the topic of Avodah Zarah. Avodah Zarah is one of the three cardinal sins that we're not so even at the threat of losing our lives, we're not supposed to transgress this sin. And I wanted to explore this a little bit because in some ways it's very puzzling. I'll frame it like this. A few years ago when I was a middle school Rebbe, I was teaching Parshat Yitro. And when we got up to Aseret HaDibro, we got up to the commandment of not having other gods and not having idols and bowing down to them. So I went to one of the principal's office, there were actually two of them there at the same time. And I said to them, how would you explain to sixth graders what's wrong with Avodah Zarah? And one answer I got was that it's bad theology, which is true. But what I was getting at and what I want to get to tonight is that the gravity of the sin of Avodah Zarah somehow doesn't really... at least to me, it doesn't seem obvious from the outset that would be such a grave thing. And first of all, like, who have we met that creates idols and bows down to them and sees this as being such a such a significant thing in life? It's very far removed. The prohibition of Avodah Zarah, considering how much attention it gets and how severe it is, it feels kind of removed from our lives in a certain sense. And I'm not alone in having that conundrum a little bit. You know, my sources. This is something that's already discussed in the time of the Gemara. There's a really fascinating Gemara in Sanhedrin that Rav Ashi was giving shiur, and he said, you know, he gave a preview of what's coming next, and we're going to talk about three kings of Israel. And we're gonna talk about our colleagues. So these three kings were kings of I think the Northern Kingdom. Manasseh is singled out here, but three kings who were Ovdei Avodah Zarah. They were idol worshippers. They were sinners. The Navi is very clear that they did what's wrong in the eyes of Hashem, and yet the tradition is that they were great Talmidei Chachamim. They're great Torah scholars. So when Rav Ashi says we're going to talk about our colleagues, these kings who were also Talmidei Chachamim, Menashe comes to Rav Ashi in a dream and says, "How dare you call me a colleague? We're not colleagues. We're not equals. I know more than you." And he asks what seems like a very basic question about cutting bread. Truth is, I don't know how many of us we were asked this question. Where you're required to begin cutting a loaf of bread when you make hamotzi. So yeah, in some ways it's a simple question. Maybe we're not all don't have that degree of expertise. But for Rav Ashi, you would think that that he knows everything. And Rav Ashi says straight up, "I don't know." And so Menashe says, "So you know, look at this. You call me your colleague and." I'm a much greater Talmud Chacham than you. So Rav Ashi says, okay, but if that's the case, you're such a great Talmud Chacham, we generally have an assumption, Rav Heschel Schechter says this a lot, that in theory, that the greater the Talmud Chacham, the greater the Torah scholar, the greater Yirat Shamayim, the greater fear of heaven that they should have, whether that's aspirational or true. But that's Rav Ashi's question is, if you're such a great Talmud Chacham, so why would you be doing Avodah Zarah? Like, forget that... You skipped mincha one time because you were you were busy, and this is a serious thing. How could you be such a Talmid Chacham and do Avodah Zarah. And so Menashe says to him, Amar Le, Yihaveit Hatam, if you were there, Hav Nakitna B'Shipule Glima V'Ratata Batrai. If you were there, you would have taken and lifted the hem of your cloak, and you would have run after me as quickly as possible due to the great desire to do Avodah Zarah. And that really, you know, brings out the conundrum that I wanted to try to explore a little bit tonight, is that on the one hand, I think we're all kind of in the, I'm not going to call Ravashi a category. He'll come to me in a dream and he'll ask me lots of shilas that I don't know. But we're kind of in the category of Ravashi in the sense that we wouldn't understand what's so enticing about Avodah Zarah. And at the same time, apparently it was so enticing. So I want to understand that a little bit more and why it's so severe. There's also Gemara and Yoma that talks about the Chazal were accepting the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash, and a fiery lion comes from the Kodesh Kodashim, and Zechariah says this is the Yetzer Hara for Avodah Zarah, Hainu Yitzra da Avodah Zarah. So they catch this fiery lion and say, okay, so we have the Yetzer Hara of Avodah Zarah. What do we do with it now? So they decide that they're going to kill it. And that was how the Yetzer Hara of Avodah Zarah was killed. So essentially we have it explicit in Chazal in both these places that that Avodah Zarah once was extremely enticing. And apparently now we don't really have that Yetzer Hara, or we don't understand it certainly. So with that said, the Torah was given for all generations. And so I want to understand a little bit more, first of all, what is Avodah Zarah? Not in the most technical halachic definitions, because that would take a very, very long time to discuss, but to get a sense of what is Avodah Zarah and what's wrong with it, and what are some ways that this becomes relevant in our lives. So let's begin, and we're going to explore the Mefarshim a little bit to unpack this a little bit. So Torah tells us in Aseret HaDibrot in chapter 20 of Shmot, Lo yelecha Elohim acharim al panai, you have no other gods besides me. Pretty simple. Lo tase lecha peso v'chol tmuna asher b'shamayim mima'al v'asher ba'aretz mitachat v'asher b'mayim mitachat la'aretz. You should not have a sculptured image or any likeness of what is in the heavens above or on earth below or in the waters under earth. Lo tishtachaveh lahem velo ta'avdeim, not bow down to them or serve them. Ki anochi Hashem lokecha kel kana. I am they translate it here as impassion, but in some ways it's envious. And we're going to talk about that a little bit. Poked avot avanim al sheushim v'arbeim l'sonai. And I visit the guilt of parents upon children, upon the third and the fourth generations of those who reject me. But I show kindness to the thousandth generation of those who love me and keep my commandments. But this latter part we're not going to explore as much, but this is a basic framing of the prohibition of idol worship as it's portrayed in Aseret HaDibrot, that we're not supposed to have other gods, and we're not supposed to sculpture images of the firmaments of some of the sort of celestial bodies. So Rashi has a couple of questions on this. We'll start with Rashi. So Rashi says, why does it say lo yiyelecha Elohim acharim? And why does it say lo ta'aselecha? Right? Lo yiyelecha means that you shall have no other gods. But on the other hand, it also says you shall not make yourself these idols. So it seems like maybe there's something a little bit superfluous, but also there's a sort of contrasting formulation here. So Rashi says, based on a mechilta, that when it says lo ta'aseh lecha, ein li ela shelo yaseh. So if I were to just say, don't make any idols, that means don't make any idols. Hasui kvar minayim shelo kayim. But what if I have an extra neighbor who says, you know, I have this wonderful Buddha that I would like to give you. We're moving away. Want to get rid of it. So, okay, I didn't make it, but it's going to sit in my house. So how do I know that that's not allowed? Lo yiyelecha. So we get both those. You're not allowed to make it, and you're not allowed to possess it. So that's one comment that Rashi makes. There's two other comments that Rashi really makes. So the other difficulty is, why does it say, lo yelecha Elohim achrim, should not have other gods? It's almost like kind of giving credence to the fact that maybe there are other gods. Right? If I say don't have other gods, I'm acknowledging that there's a possibility of there being other gods. So how does that work? So Rashi explains, she'enan elohut ela achrim asa Elohim aleihem. They're not really divine, but we're talking about the way other people perceive it. Other people have accepted these as gods, so it's like in air quotes, like you should not have other gods. But obviously, of course, we can't literally call them other gods, because that would be obviously insulting and disrespectful to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. But the other answer, which is this is a really interesting answer that's brought here, is that what it means, Elohim Acherim, Shehem Acherim Lo Deham. It's a little bit more of a homiletic, there's a little bit of a homiletic idea here, that they are others to the people who worship them, that you call out to them, you scream to them, and they don't answer. And they're other in the sense that it's like as if you don't exist, right? They're totally, in a different realm. You don't exist to them, and they don't really exist to you. For those who are familiar with the story of Eliyahu on Har Carmel, so he had a little bit of showdown with people who with Bnei Israel, who were worshiping the Baal deity, and they have this little showdown and to show accepted sacrifices. So the Baal prophets try all these different things to try to get Baal to respond, and nothing's coming. And Eliyahu starts mocking them, like, "Oh, sorry, I'm sorry. Is your God asleep? Is that why he's not answering you?" So that's this Elohim Achirim, is that they don't really they don't hear you, they don't care about you, and they don't respond to you, as opposed to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So that's the way Rashi understands this. Again, sort of two different things, but Ramban's going to address both of these, that we're not supposed to make or possess idols. And in terms of what it means to have Elohim Acherim, they're not, we would never call something actually an other god, but it's just the expression. So Rabban, and as we go through these Mefarshim, I'm not just trying to go through, just to show everything that's there, but we'll get some slightly different angles from each of the Mefarshim about what is going on with Avodah Zarah. So Ramban responds to Rashi's first comment, that you have lo yelecha and lo ta'aseh, that you shouldn't possess and you shouldn't make idols, and that's based on Mechilta. And Ramban says that Rashi is quoting the Mechilta is quoting a das yachid. It's quoting a singular opinion, which is not really something. Maybe in the commentary in Chumash, maybe there's room for that, depending on your approach. But certainly, as far as halacha is concerned, we generally do not accept minority opinions. We usually go according to the majority. So he shows that the Sifra really says that there's a pasuk in Parsha Kedoshim that says, "V'lohei masecha lo tasu lachem," that you should not make masks, which are essentially these idols. So you should not make these for you. So why does it say for you? So on the one hand, lo ta'asu, you can't make them. On the other hand, lachem, so that other people shouldn't make it for you. And from here we learn that somebody who makes an idol for themselves violates two commandments. One is lo ta'asu, and one is the aspect of lachem, that you shouldn't do this for yourselves. And Rabbi Yossi is the one who adds on that we also learn this from our parsha, from lo yelecha Elohim Acherim. So according to Ramban, the what lo yelecha Elohim Acherim, this whole dibra is not telling us that we're not supposed to make idols. Well, sorry, lo tasalacha tells you that you're not supposed to make idols, but Loyelecha is not talking about idols per se, and that's where you get this. That's also how you resolve the Elohim Acherim. What's with Elohim Acherim? That obviously doesn't make sense because Lo Yelecha Elohim Acherim is telling us that you're not supposed to accept upon yourself that there's another deity. It's not necessarily about any sort of object or creation, but Lo Yelecha Elohim Acherim, according to Ramban, is about the just the basic acceptance of the of there being another a deity, and he spells that out here by saying. That we should not accept any other God besides Hashem. And then we get into that you shouldn't make a pestle and tzbunah, shouldn't make idols or and images that one might bow down to, right? So when it says lo yelecha Elohim Acherim, that's not that there's no bowing down that's connected to that because it's not real because Elohim Acherim is not talking about idols, but it's saying something even more basic, saying something even more basic that you're not supposed to even abstractly accept that there is another deity. Another comment that the Ramban makes is that that and this is putting this in conjunction with Anochi Hashem Elokecha that I am Hashem and I'm Hashem alone. They shouldn't include others along with me. That's something that that gets discussed a lot. Is that maybe it's one thing to reject God in favor of other deities, but what if I say I believe in God, I believe in the Jewish God, whatever that means, but I also I do a little bit of Hinduism and ancient Egyptian idolatry. I accept all of it. So Ramban says that this is telling us that we're not supposed to accept other gods. He also points out that this is the one place in the Torah where God is described as being a kel kana, that he's a jealous God. It's only with the Avodah Zarah that he's described that way. So why is he described that way? Vatamakina, the idea behind the jealousy is that we're treasure possession that was set for Hashem. And he compares it to the idea of kina that one finds in the episode of the Sota that appears in Parshat Naso. So the expression that is used is that the husband is mikaneh in his wife, that the husband suspects adultery. And the husband is mekaneh, and we're comparing this relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, which is a theme in Parshat Yitro in general, that there's a sort of a marital union between HaKadosh Baruch Hu and Bnei Yisrael. So the issues that come up with having idols, accepting other gods, all of that creates a kin'ah in HaKadosh Baruch Hu because we have a unique relationship, and it's a violation of that relationship to have other gods. So if we look back, again, and one of the examples in Rashi, so one of the problems with Avodah Zarah is that they're not real and they don't respond and they don't do anything for us. Another problem that the Ramban is bringing out here, particularly talking about the Kina, is that it's a violation of our relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And Ramban goes on to talk a little bit about different kinds of idolatry. First, it was worshiping angels who, again, are working for HaKadosh Baruch Hu. But we're gonna have a relationship with the intermediaries as well. So it started with worshiping angels, and there's another kind of worshiping the constellations and the sun and the moon. And this comes from an idea that that every tribe has its own, saying more globally, that every tribe has its own constellation that protects them. So like it's my constellation versus yours, and they're going to duke it out. So if I worship my mazal properly, so that will work out for me. And then there's idolatry that relates to demons and the spirits. So if I were to, again, just to summarize between Rashi and Ramban, Avodah Zarah is certainly physical manifestations of let's say like the sun, the moon, stars, constellations, the luminaries and the celestial bodies. And but it also could involve worshiping angels. It can even be accepting the true God along with other deities. And what's problematic is that besides the fact that it's wrong, it is it shows a bit of infidelity, and that it's also not a real relationship, and it's a violation of the relationship. So that's what I have from Rashi and Ramban. The Haraz Kanim, the Baalei Tosfot, and trying to even understand what the purpose of let's say it this. What if I say that I'm not going to worship other gods, but one thing I will do, and this is kind of like an Igal Azav kind of situation, perhaps, is that God is this mysterious hidden being that I can't see. So I'm going to make a depiction of God so that I can have some sort of concept of who it is that I serve and who I'm worshiping. Right? It's hard for people to worship God in an abstract sense. So I'm gonna make some sort of image to help me understand that a little bit. But as Haraz Kanim point out, that something that's problematic here is that if you're gonna make a tmuna, if you're gonna make a picture of God, well, you've never seen God. So basically, whatever you do to create God is going to limit God, and it's also going to distort God, and that's also incorrect and problematic. The Ibn Ezra points out that the issue with Avodah Zarah is not just, and this ties back a little bit with Ramban, that unlike other mitzvah, where generally speaking you don't violate a mitzvah unless you act on something, with Avodah Zarah, Halacha says that even having an internal acceptance of Avodah Zarah, if it's Baalei, even if I don't tell anybody about it, but I believe in Avodah Zarah in my heart, so that is also a violation. So that also underscores some of the severity of Avodah Zarah, and as we understand from the Ibn Ezra, the gravity of Avodah Zarah is in not just what I do, but in my internal complexion. Rashbam explains that part of the problem with Avodah Zarah is that maybe it shows ingratitude to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, that I was the one who took you out of Egypt. It wasn't anything else. So why shouldn't you have other gods? Very simply because I'm your God, and I'm the one who took you out of Egypt. So that obviously connects with the pasuk at the beginning of the Dibrot, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is I am your God who took you out of Egypt, and the fact that you shouldn't have other gods is connected to that. Rav Shimon Schwab, who was the rabbi, the rabbi started. Well, he was born in Germany in Frankfurt. He was able to get out before the Shoah and came to Baltimore, and then he was a longtime rabbi of the Breuer's community in Washington Heights, a very illustrious German community. So in his commentary on the Torah, Mayam Beis HaShoeva, so he talks about the idea of Hakaras HaTov. Why would people worship other idols? Because maybe I should have gratitude. Maybe I should gratitude to the sun. I love the sun. I love daylight. So maybe I should show my gratitude to the sun. And maybe I love the snow because maybe it gives a snow day. So I'm going to worship the snow as well. And all these different things play a role in the world. So maybe I would want to show my Hakaras HaTov. And he says, Om nam yadua shemidas Hakaras HaTov hi misode derech eretz shekadma l'Torah. Of course, Hakaras HaTov is a very foundational a value. We're not going to say that one shouldn't be grateful and express their gratitude in a way that shows that we appreciate what we have. But it's misdirected. That it doesn't belong to the sun and the moon and the stars and all that, because really all those are servants of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And in fact, they're really forced to do what HaKadosh Baruch Hu does. So it's one thing to thank a human being, whether it's an authority figure like a king or a parent or anybody else who helps us. So it's one thing to kind of have a little bit of indebtedness to a human being because they choose to do something for you, and therefore a Karsa Tov is appropriate. But the Avodah Zarah involved in idol worship, the problem with Avodah Zarah in that sense is that it's misdirected Hakara Satov. It's misdirected gratitude. A distortion of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and our gratitude belongs. We're going to give our gratitude to something that is beyond us. It belongs to HaKadosh Baruch Hu and nobody else. In a similar sense, the Kli Yakar suggests that that part of the problem with the Avodah Zarah is that that maybe we look at certain things and we think that they're powerful. That you look at the sea and you see something, that the sea is a war hero, and Har Sinai you see things that are important to you in these items, and therefore you might worship them. Maybe you think that these are different aspects of the world, different components, and they're all these sort of independent, autonomous objects and ideas, and that's part of the error of Avodah Zarah as well. Is looking at what's in front of us and saying, well, this is a god, and this is something that controls us, and that definitely relates a little bit to the ideas behind Greek mythology, is that you have the sea god and you have the sun god and you have this and that, and they fight each other as we mentioned. They have that there's that competing aspect of it, but that's how people sometimes actually looked at some of these bodies, as being these independent autonomous things, which is not true. Part of the problem with that, the Kli Yakar goes on to explain, is that these kinds of that God does not change. God, Hayah Hoveh V'Yihyeh, God always exists and will always exist, and God is always the same. Whereas idols, and even things that aren't idols, but if you're again talking about different landforms and land masses, all of that can change over the course of time. The only constant in the world is HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So, in that sense, it almost makes me think of like fads. That, and we find this, that there are different forms of spirituality and different fads that exist. And we convince ourselves that, that this is the most important thing in the world, and this is the right path of spirituality, and this is the new thing that's in. And all of a sudden, in 10, 15 years, people have changed to something else. So as far as having a value system and a course of life and meaning and having a stability in the world, the only thing that really works is HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Everything else is going to be a fad of some sort. Rabbeinu Bachya says that part of the enticement of Avodah Zarah is that we might think that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is king of the world, and if there's billions of people who were to talk to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, so maybe he doesn't really care about my insignificant, if a child prays that the Jets should win the Super Bowl next year, besides that maybe being a tefillas hashav, maybe that's a vain prayer, but God doesn't care about my little things. Even my things are big things, they're still little things. So maybe I should create some sort of intermediary that will care a little bit more. So that's also a particular issue with Avodah Zarah. Rabbeinu Bachya points out that So he also says that maybe also that there's a zikaral nisim niflaot shasa kadosh baruch hu Yisrael. Maybe also if I were to create a statue of a frog. So, well, Kadosh Baruch Hu wanted us to remember the Makos in Yitzhiyah Mitzrayim and things like that. So maybe I should make idols that represent Yitzhiyah Mitzrayim. And that's also problematic because if I make those things, then I will bow down to them. But again, we're not thanking the frogs for Yitzhiyah Mitzrayim. We thank HaKadosh Baruch Hu, right? All that belongs to HaKadosh Baruch Hu and to HaKadosh Baruch Hu only. Okay. Right. So what I mentioned before was the Or HaChaim. The Or HaChaim is the one who says that maybe my needs are immaterial and Kadosh Baruch Hu is not interested in me, but that is in fact a taus. So again, the Mefarshim present a lot of different angles in terms of what Avodah Zarah is and why it's problematic. A, because it's not it's a lie, it's a fallacy, it's not true. B, because it's not helpful, because it doesn't actually do anything for us. C, because it's a sort of a phony relationship that Avodah Zarah doesn't respond to us. And in a similar sense, also there's a bit of infidelity, right? So there's the relationship piece that if we're supposed to have a relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu or with any sort of thing at all, so you have a problem there. There's also an aspect that if one has, let's say, what the Ramban was talking about, that you shouldn't be mishatef something else with meat. So, there's an expression, that you can't have two kings with the same crown. If you have two gods and you have two different loyalties, you have split loyalties, you have dual loyalties, you end up going back to, what we were saying before, that these factions can be fighting each other. And if we're supposed to have Kabbalah's Al Malchus Shamayim, if we're supposed to accept the yoke of God upon ourselves, so you can't really be loyal to God if you have multiple loyalties. There's also a sense of misdirected Hakar Satov. There's this, we're not directing our gratitude and also our requests to the right place. It shows a lack of understanding there, and we're underplaying and denying the role of HaKadosh Baruch Hu in doing so. And also a lot of these forms of Avodah Zarah are fads that develop over time, and they bring us down the wrong path, bring us down an incorrect path. And if we want to figure out what our life course should be and what's important and how the world should work, so we have to have a sort of a fixed we have to have a God who's fixed, whose word is true and eternal and remains. One thing that I found in the Koran, Land of Israel, Tanakh, that was interesting. So it talks about the prohibitions of polytheism and idolatry, and they point out that basically everybody was polytheistic except for Bnei Israel. So they write, this is Professor Jeremiah Unterman, the concept of idolatry refers to a belief that the living presence of a god is found in a statue or image, that physical representations of deities must be worshipped and served. The divine presence entered the image through a well-known ancient Near East magical mouth-washing ritual, which included a purification ceremony that the polytheists believed opened the mouth and enabled the statue to eat, drink, speak, hear, and smell. Again, this sounds like so foreign to us, and like we wouldn't understand why anybody would want to do this, but this is what people did. And they talk about that, that because statues represent a deity, so when a city was defeated in war, conquerors often carried away its statues to show the power of their own gods over those of the conquered city. That's obviously a very distorted understanding of power, because if power is that, well, if I can destroy your idols, my God is better than yours. So besides the fact that, again, it's false, it creates a very problematic power dynamic as well. And through having one God who cannot be represented in image, we show that God cannot be reduced to any object. Okay. I want to transition for a second to talk about the idea that Kadosh Baruch Hu is Kel Kana, which is something I think that's troubling about Avodah Zarah, is why is it that Kadosh Baruch Hu, why should God be jealous? God should be above feelings and emotions, and So what if people believe in other gods? What's the problem with that? So we get a hint of that already from the Ramban about the sort of the infidelity aspect of this. And Rashi points out that Kadosh Baruch Hu doesn't forgive this easily either. So Ibn Ezra says, Kidinhu achar she Hashem barachav hu mechaye otcha eich titein kvoda la'acher asher lo yetev lo yira. And so again, it's this gratitude aspect Rav Schwab was saying that if HaKadosh Baruch Hu created you, and also HaKadosh Baruch Hu has the power over your life, so you have no business giving kavod to you have no business giving kavod to anything else. It's wrong and distorted. Agrippas, one of the generals in the time of the Second Temple, asked Rabban Gamliel, why does God need to be jealous? He asked this very question, right? People who are wise are only jealous of other people who are of the same or greater level, right? Or somebody who's wealthy is jealous of people who are wealthier than them, not people who are less. But if HaKadosh Baruch Hu is the only God, so why should he have any real jealousy then? Everything else by definition is lesser. So he too, so this, so the Alkut Shimoni here also points out the issue of infidelity that we saw with the Ramban. On the one hand, a lack of gratitude, which is central to the relationship, on the other hand, the infidelity that is such a serious breach. And we can understand that metaphor the way that people's lives are ruined through infidelity in relationships. So it just shows that how the effect that worshiping other gods has on their relationship with God. Yabar Benel says, So what's interesting about Avodah Zarah that the Yabar Benel points out is that the question points out is why should we say that Kadosh Baruch Hu is jealous? Why shouldn't we just say that that you shouldn't worship other gods because God brought you out of Egypt? And the answer is because Avodah Zarah is prohibited for Bnei Noach also, for Noachites also, and therefore even though we saw above that part of the importance of the relationship with the Kadosh Baruch Hu is that he's the one who brought us out of Egypt. But at the same time, that's not really the totality of it, because the Kadosh Baruch Hu also existed, and we believe, and monotheism was important before that also. So that brings that sense of the importance of the commitment that's even outside of anything in particular that Kadosh Baruch Hu has done for us, but about the importance of the relationship. Soloveitchik talks about this concept of kina in the Sefer Pesach Sefirot HaOmer and Shavuot. So they go through some of his lectures, and he goes through the Dibrot in a little bit of depth, and talks about in a great deal of depth, and talks about what's going on there. So what he says about jealousy, he says, when is jealousy, the resentment of rivalry, justified? Right? Again, our starting assumption should be that kina is not really a good thing. So he says, in fact, sometimes this attitude is very selfish. When is this spirit of possessiveness, of domineering possessiveness, justified? On the whole, people don't like jealous persons. A person can be jealous of his property, for example. No one can enter his home because he might leave a stain on the rug. This mania for cleanliness is a form of possessiveness. Such a person sees his possessiveness as part of him. So that's generally not a good trait to have. So he compares this to the relationship that a child has with their parents, and the way that that a parent is possessive over their child. So he points out this is kind of interesting. He says when he was learning Chumash in Cheder, when he was 5 or 6, and the Torah says Al ken yazov ish et aviv v'imo, that person's going to leave their parents in order to get married, and the Rav, at Yosef Dov at five years old, thinks, leaving my parents? Why would I ever leave my parents? I'm never going to leave my parents, because that's how a 5-year-old thinks. But that's the way life goes so far. That's the way that life goes sometimes. So what do we learn from this? He says there's only one commitment that's infinite, absolute, and permanent. It is the one between man and God, because man cannot exist without God. And that's why there's jealousy. And that's why this commitment cannot be shared with anybody. That's why jealousy is justified. And that's why it says, Kel Kana, I am God intolerant, am intolerant of sharing. I want man for myself, and not just as a part of man, but the whole of man. That's why he resents Avodah Zarah so much. The Rav, in many of his writings, gives a certain personification to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, you know, to help us understand the dynamics here. But it goes back to this idea that we saw, I think, in the Kli Yakar, that everything in life is mishtana, right? Even parts of nature that seem permanent, everything can change. The only thing that's a true commitment that can last is a Kadosh Baruch Hu, and therefore the importance of that commitment is that's where the true bond lies. I'd be remiss if I didn't mention anything from the Mishnah Torah, from the Rambam. The Rambam in Hilchot Avodah Zarah does not just give the halachas of Avodah Zarah, but he goes through the whole history of how Adam HaRishon started with a belief in one God, but how each generation, as things went along, so they started discovering other things and they started clinging towards other forms of idolatry. And then came Avraham Avinu, and he taught the world about HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And then Yitzchak did the same thing, and Yitzchak taught Yaakov as well, and Yaakov taught his children. But when Bnei Yisrael went to Mitzrayim, when Bnei Yisrael went to Egypt, and they began to learn idolatry again, except for Shevet Levi, the tradition is that Shevet Levi did not do Avodah Zarah. But that's you know, there's both the Rambam and Kabbalah has an, you know, talks about how Bnei Yisrael were involved. Get this, Haggadah, that Bnei Yisrael was engaged in Avodah Zarah in Egypt. And he says, Kimat kat haya ikar sheshata Avram nekar. Almost everything that could have, that Avram Avinu planted was uprooted. The Chozer Bnei Yaakov letaota olam etiotan, and the sons of Yaakov went back to the world's original mistakes. But because of HaKadosh Baruch Hu's love for us and his promise to Avraham Avinu, he sent Moshe and redeemed us. V'achar Hashem Yisrael l'nachala. Kevan sheni nabem Moshe Rabbeinu v'achar Hashem Yisrael l'nachala. Because HaKadosh Baruch Hu chose us as his nation, tichtiran v'mitzvot, he crowned us with commandment. V'riyam derech avodata umayyam mishpat avodah kochav v'choa ta'im achareah. And so he taught us the way to serve him and what happens to Avodah Zarah and those who will continue to do that afterwards. So for the Rambam, Avodah Zarah is actually a very central part of what the Torah is all about. And you get that in the Guide of the Perplexed when the Rambam is about to explain the reasons for all the commandments. And if you look in all sorts of areas of Machshavas, you get all sorts of different reasons for the commandments. And the Rambam... And the Rambam says that the principal purpose of the whole law was the removal and utter destruction of idolatry, right? Which again only underscores the fact that we have to understand why idolatry is so bad. If that's the whole purpose of the Torah, it's got to be something that's really bad that the Torah is coming and trying to correct all of that. And Nachum Rabinovich in the Yad of Shuta, in his commentary on the Rambam, points out that first of all, the fact that the Rambam emphasizes as being a concern that goes for future generations shows that there's some relevance to Avodah Zarah. It's not just something in the past, even though it seems like we don't have a Yetzer Hara, we're not creating idols and we're not bowing down to them and it's not something that interests us, but somehow it's still relevant. And this is where I want to get into some of the more concrete ways that Avodah Zarah perhaps is relevant in our world today. So Rev Rabinovich talks about that the importance of preventing Avodah Zarah is about preventing us from falling into frivolous things. And he says, Sakanazu urevet lanu tamid. This danger is always there. He says, Gam hitkadmud mada'e hateva v'chashifat chukot shamayim v'aretz einan aruva shelo yigaru b'nei adam acharedim yono masot shav. Now we shouldn't, you know, even though we think we're so civilized, and we have a science and technology, we shouldn't think that we're so immune. Because the danger of Avodah Zarah is always when one can't tell that which is true from that which is false. And so therefore, the ongoing battle of Avodah Zarah, even as we think that we're, less reliant on uber magical things because we have technology, we still have to be concerned about truth. And he goes on to point out that one of the issues of Avodah Zarah that still exists today is he says these itonim nefutzim ofim turim kvuim leim havalim vehazayot shel astrologia. They have the columns that people the fortune telling columns and the zodiacs and people go to. He says even people who are observant will go to these fortune tellers and the palm readers and things like that. And he says, even though proper Avodah Zarah doesn't necessarily exist the way that it did before, the only way to keep the proper path of life is through learning the Torah. So we might not have the same kind of Avodah Zarah temptations that our ancestors had, but we still have certain desires to look into the future and those kinds of things that that again are entirely misplaced and they are entirely false. We're running short on time, but one thing that that the Rav emphasizes in his discussion of idolatry is that and he talks about that given the idolatry that existed previously and HaKadosh Baruch Hu brought us out of Egypt and he taught us, so maybe there shouldn't have been idolatry, would have learned our lesson. And yet something, this is something that continues to take place. So he says it's noteworthy that the injunction is against idolatry, not against atheism. It's not as bad to believe in no God than it is to believe in other gods. And why is that? He says, because there's no such thing as atheism, really. That if you don't believe in God, you end up believing in something else. You end up believing in science and technology and in people and in power. That's something that the Rav goes on to talk about is the way that people worship political leaders and power. All of those are elements of Avodah Zarah. Rav Hirsch talks about Avodah Zarah in a certain sense as well. That he says that he talks about Yishtachaviyah versus Avodah. Yishtachaviyah dehain Yishtachu gemura ala aretz. Yibitui lehid maser gemura be'efes maisa. That when we bow down to an idol, we're giving ourselves entirely to something else. So if I'm not allowed to, if Avodah Zarah is problematic, that means that I'm not allowed to not only worship other gods, but even if I believe in God, I'm not supposed to have other loyalties. In other words, my loyalties have to be straight to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And that concern still exists today, that there are concerns that we sort of split our priorities in life, that we might, again, prioritize, that we might be servants to money. We might see money as being a priority. We might see pleasure as being a priority. And that's something that Rav Hirsch also talks about in Chorev, his explanation of all the mitzvot. He says that you shouldn't think that Avodah Zarah is merely a mistake. It's not just a mistake, right? Which is what many of us would have thought, that it's okay. I believe the wrong thing, but so what? But he says that when one believes in Avodah Zarah, one goes down the wrong path of seeking pleasure. He says there's still Arche Adam Hayoshev Tzedek Shel Maasav. We still have issues of justice. There's still a moral component to making sure that we're not involved in Avodah Zarah. And the Akedas Yitzchak talks about the money aspect of it that we mentioned. The Nesiv Shalom, the Thonim Rebbe, talks about the Taivos aspect of it. So again, with time, I'm not going to go through all these in depth, but when you go through some of these, especially Acharonim, people who lived in the last few hundred years, who are trying to sort of explain the relevance of Avodah Zarah, there's still elements of Avodah Zarah in this world, that if I'm enslaved to money, if I'm enslaved to my Yitzhar, I'm enslaved to to seeking pleasure, which distracts me from serving Kodesh Baruch Hu and from doing, you know, whatever it is that's important in life and productive for society. All of those are forms of avodah zarah. And again, I mentioned the Rav who talks about the political aspect of it. Also, you know, whether it's Marxism or even in American politicians, he says with regard to Roosevelt, Jews made an avodah zarah of FDR, right? Versus the fact that FDR did not help as he should have during the Shoah. So that's a discussion for another time. But we can understand how people might worship politicians and see them as being, you know, this is the great hope of our generation. Not necessarily the case. HaKadosh Baruch Hu is Redeemer, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu is our hope, but it's folly to assume that that's in man. Where I want to conclude, and then we have a couple minutes for questions, is that the very first Rashi I mentioned talked about how that the idea of Elohim Acherim, that there are other gods, so to speak, that they are acherim to us, that you call out to a false god, and it's not going to answer, it's not going to respond to you, and it doesn't care. And this reminds me of the foundational concept of Martin Buber, the I Thou concept that he elaborates on in the book, I Thou. I can't claim that I really understand the whole book. I read it, but it's difficult. It's very high-level philosophy, but there's a basic aspect of I, thou. There's I, thou, which is I, you, that I can relate to somebody as a you, not just as an object in front of me, but as we're connecting and we're in a genuine relationship versus something that's an I, it, that they're another object. And he says, this conception presupposes that man's relation to finite gods he has idolized is of the same nature as his relation to God. When he's talking about idolatry, he says that, you know, that you can't even assume that if one's worshiping other gods, that they're making it similar to capital G God. But a man's relationship to the special something that usurps the throne of the supreme value of his life and supplants eternity rests always on experiencing and using an it, a thing, an object of enjoyment. For this relation alone is able to obstruct the prospect which opens towards God. It is the impenetrable world of it. But the relation which involves the saying of the thou opens up this prospect ever anew. He who is dominated by the idol that he wishes to win, to hold, and to keep has no way to God but that of reversal, which is a change not only of goal, but also of the nature of his movement. So if we want to have a genuine relationship with God, there's no place for other things. And in fact, I would say one of the most compelling ways of understanding Avodah Zarah is that Avodah Zarah is this acher, that whatever it is in life that people worship, right? When people call celebrities an idol, right? So that's literally what they are. They're idols because whoever the best football player is, you know, he might care about his fans like a larger sense, but he doesn't care about you as an individual. So that's so I think that's, you know, one the takeaway when it comes to Avodah Zarah is that we have HaKadosh Baruch Hu, we have a powerful relationship with, and we owe him our devotion, our loyalty, our gratitude. But the only true, genuine relationship and the only consistent relationship that we can have in life and that will never be taken away is that with a HaKadosh Baruch Hu. That should leave us something to think about in terms of our own, in terms of the way we worship HaKadosh Baruch Hu and how we relate to God, that the prohibition of Avodah Zarah is meant to create something very powerful in the relationship with God. Okay, I know I went on for a long time. I'm curious to hear people's thoughts because it's because this is in some ways it's not an easy topic to wrap our heads around what's going on with idolatry and what is it even and why is it so bad. So I hope I gave some helpful approaches, but I'm happy to hear others. Avodah Zarah and misplaced or skewed priorities are different things. Communist Soviet Union, the question a little boy asks is, Daddy, do you love me more than you love Stalin? So that is a skewed.
So somebody could ask, Daddy, do you love God more than you love your family? And, just because I love money doesn't mean that's avodah zarah. That's a certain kind of priority.
So that,
and that's, and people need reaffirmation. I'm assuming most people tell their loved ones they love them. God doesn't tell us on a regular basis he loves us. It's unknowable and ineffable. So people look for something that gives them some kind of insight or control, or at least some glimpse of what's going on. And I understand that impulse.
Right. So there, and there's definitely a place for that. And of course, you know, money is important, and that's how we live. And of course, Baruch Hu wants us to have a parnasa. But again, when does that cross over into worshiping that in a way that's toxic and skew morality? I mean, people who go so far with some of these things can bring real harm to the world. You know, Paro, you know, if we talk about like worshiping people, like Paro thought of himself as a deity. That has tremendous moral implications. So that, you know,
yes, but if you're an Egyptian, Paro can affect your life very positively if he so chooses, also very negatively. There's a direct connection. For somebody to tell me, read the text and I'll feel God's presence, or go to shul and I don't feel God's presence and I'm left cold, is problematic for some people. You can tell me all you want that doing the mitzvah brings me a connection, but if I don't feel it, I don't feel it, and I'm left with a problem.
Sure, sure. I definitely hear that. I definitely hear that.
I'd like to suggest that the reason why Breshit tells us God made man in his tmunah is to tell us, to explain the mitzvah, the prohibition of making tmunot. And according to Rashi's second explanation, which you explained so well, acherim means not gods who did not create man in their image.
Meaning like we're saying that these pictures are something that's outside of the image that God created of the whole world. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah.
That's interesting. I like that. I like that a lot.
Anybody else want to? I always like to say, if I may, you know, that the Gemara quoted, of course, at the beginning in Yuma, that the rabbis did away with Avodah Zarah. But I think at the same time, they did away with a little bit of Avodah. You know, people who've heard me over the years have heard, I always like to quote Rabbi Gemara here in Toronto, heard this from him many years ago, that I think he was quoting Rav Kook, but I'm not sure. Ask him that Avodah Zarah is Avodah that just went a little off the rails. In other words, you can't have Avodah with, they go together. Avodah Zarah is Avodah, it's worship of God, but it's foreign, it's something we don't accept. But they go, you know, if you get rid of Avodah Zarah, you get rid of Avodah too. And the same way we lost our desire to worship idols, so to speak, it's much harder to worship God. And that's, you know.
And that comes up. That comes up when they tried to also get rid of the Yetzer Hara for relationships. So the world literally wouldn't exist. So they had to walk back. But I never thought of it in terms of this particular piece. But you're right that there, that same cost benefit is there as well.
I think that's true in everything in religious life. I always say, you know, it's the corollary to Newton's third law of motion. For every action, there's an opposite and equal reaction. For every potential for good, there's a potential for evil. And the greater, like if a Avodah Zarah is really evil, you know, the vote is really great. But if you diminish one, you diminish the, you know, opposite and equal reaction too. So it I think it is a lot harder. It's hard to do a vote at Hashem, you know. Yeah. So it's easy to do mitzvot, but it's hard to do a vote at Hashem, or relatively easy. But all right, nobody else.
So there's one more comment. I'll just respond to this comment. I think also relates to Ben's comment that again, I don't think that. Now, obviously, if you have everything in the right perspective in terms of relationships, in terms of the things that we have in our lives, so all that is healthy and normal. I mean, that's the difference between something that's normal and something that's a pathology, right? If you look at it, like if you were to put this in sort of like a psychological context, is something goes from being normal to pathological when it becomes something that's distressing or dangerous or damaging it in some ways. And that's the line here, is that, of course, we're not saying that a person shouldn't have relationships with other people in their lives. They shouldn't love their family, that they shouldn't enjoy food, and that they shouldn't have an appreciation for money. But the over-prioritization, I would say, that becomes avodah zarah is that when it goes to the most extreme end of a sort of pathological worship of it, that's when it becomes avodah zarah. But done in its normal way, you know, of course, that's...
But isn't that what we've done with rabbinic Judaism? Judaism, as biblically, assuming that that's the better one, because that's closer to Sinai, didn't take up a lot of your day. There really wasn't Torah study. You went, Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur were solitary affairs in your house. The regali, maybe people went once or twice in their lifetime, and they went about their lives. It didn't crowd out everything else. Today, rabbinic Judaism, especially in certain forms, tries to crowd out everything else. Literature, regular society, all that stuff. We've never spent, as a people, more time, those who are what you would call Torah Jews, with Judaism than we ever did in the past. It's not biblical Judaism if you assume that biblical Judaism is superior. Because it's rabbinic Judaism.
There's definitely some very fundamental differences in that sense.
I think we would agree that rabbinic Judaism, it's not meant to be only biblical Judaism. It's meant for rabbinic. I mean, he's raising there's a whole other issue that we can't all deal with now. But it reminds me of Chaim Soloveitchik's comment at the end of his classic article, Rupture and Reconstruction, that we replaced the fear of heaven with the fear of the Shulchan Aruch, which of course was a criticism that is true. We do put too much, often too much emphasis on the minuet of Halacha. I was just reading, Rav Amital's comment, from the great Rosh Yeshiva of Yeshiva. I assume when you were in the Haaretz, he was still Rosh Yeshiva, right?
I went post college, so
you went post college, so he wasn't there. He had already passed away when you came to Gush. Yeah. Okay, so Rav Amital wrote that, like, when he was in Hungary, when he grew up in Hungary, Halacha wasn't like, people didn't like talk about halacha all day. They didn't worry about the Shulchan Aruch. There was just sort of a natural way. That's sort of what Chaim Soloveitchik was talking about. There was sort of a natural way. They didn't worry about what the Raman, the Shach, and the Taz just lived. And today, he was criticizing the focus that we have on every little thing to worry about what's halacha here. And I guess that's like, the 600 pages book on Sfiras Omer. Like, Hilchot Sfiras Omer was one line in the Shulchan Aruch. And, art school, I don't mean if you blame art school, but, they put out a 500-page book on Sfiras Omer. So that is new, I think. And that's what you're, he's referring to, Yossi, but, it's in terms of, but that's a broader discussion.
Just wait until you see the 500-page book on Hilchos Trimal, and then you'll wonder.
They have to, today it's true. Everything, because everything became halachicized. I don't know what, I just made up that word, like every little, and whatever. It's how do you find the balance? Halacha is how we live our life, but where do you find the balance? But anyways. Okay, any other comments? Otherwise, we'll wish everybody a Laila Tov and Shabbat Shalom. And my shir tomorrow, 9:15, continuing getting to the end of the Shmon Esrei. It's going through the Amida. That's 9:15 Sunday morning. Rabbi Liptak, as always, kicks off our series at 11:15 and all our regular shiurim next week. And I want to wish everybody, Tu B'Shvat. I know it's not officially Tu B'Shvat anymore, although maybe if you're in California, it still is, or almost Hawaii, it's still Tu B'Shvat anyways. But everybody should, the trees is, the symbolism of trees in Judaism is very deep. Ki Adam Eitz HaSadeh, and many more. Okay, everybody. Thank you, Rabbi, and be well. And all the best, and enjoy the lack of snow, but we'll enjoy the snow here.
But Rabbi Jay, as an accountant, Tu B'Shvat is just a form of revenue recognition. It's a form of revenue recognition. Yeah. That's all it was meant to be.
I don't know if that's all it is, but correct. What he's referring to is the halachas of Tu B'Shvat is what year is the fruit tithe in? The second or third year is it Maser Sheni, Maser Ani? That's correct. It does have, you want to use revenue implication. Everything in life has revenue implications. So that's the way, that's why the first question is Nasata Venatata Bemuna, But all right, Laila Tov, everybody. Hope to see you soon. Invite a friend and all the best.
Thank you.
Shalom. Thank you. Okay.